From the boardroom to the shop floor, good business runs on good governance. Join esteemed expert in governance, Dr. Nimrod Mbele, for the next hour as he takes us beyond governance, making sense of doing business in South Africa.
Your host, Nimrod Mbele, it is always my pleasure to spend this time and space with you as we dissect critical issues that shape governance landscape in the country. You know, who said South Africa is boring? South Africa is a very interesting country. I mean, Donald Trump has added a bit more spice, you know, in terms of how how South Africans, you know, react. We have noted over the past month or so, you know, by stroke of a pen, the so-called executive orders have really changed, you know, or rather sent many tongues waggling across the political, ideological spectrum. For us, it's an opportunity as a community, as a people, to set the record straight. We obviously have to get them, every South African, across the racial lines, across the class line, across business spectrum, media, the whole shebang, to set the record straight, because we are in a we live in a constitutional democracy, where the rule of law has been respected, and whatever issues that are emerging, we have that moral responsibility to set the record straight on factual issues. That's my take. Anyway, before we get into the gist of our conversation, allow me to thank Michael McKenna, who has given us a very soft landing. Thank Michael. Thank you very much for you know, critical insights that you've shared with us to date. Michael is back on your radio tomorrow at the same time. Moving along, let me express my gratitude to Vusi Masinga, who's standing in for Craig Guthrie. Vusi will navigate the show by pressing all the right buttons as we interface with the commercials. Last but not least, I want to thank Betsy, who is obviously not here today, but she often does a sterling work by, you know, putting together a list of thought leaders who grace this particular show. Moving on swiftly, if you miss any of our previous conversation, not to worry, simply go to our website, which is www.hifm.com. Download particular any podcast of your like and share your views with us. Just a quick reflection. Last week, we had a very interesting conversation with David Root, who is a director and chief economist at Efficient Group. Secondly, we were also joined by Temisa Fakuda, who is the head of English and Unit at Algeria Center for Studies. They made some very interesting observations. If you missed that particular show, you know what to do. I urge you to, you know, retrieve that particular podcast and share your views with us. In tonight's conversation, we're turning attention to the State of Nation Address. As we all know, last week Thursday, the President, in under GNU, gave us very marching orders, so to speak, in terms of what the government is planning to do in the space of electricity, in a space of infrastructure, in a space of security, in a space of social grants, and so on and so forth. He covered quite a number of issues. In making sense of this very a bouquet of you know, offering the president promised, I'm joined live. Quite fascinating. Joined online by Professor Job Mokgoro, who is a former premier of Northwest Government. We all know that Prof brings wealth of experience and insights on governance and policy. You know, together we'll explore in detail some of the themes which the president make reference to. For an example, economic recovery is obviously top of hand, because without economy, the country is not going anywhere. And we know we're quite sluggish, and he correctly pointed out. Energy security, it's a big ticket item. Unemployment, it's a big ticket item. And of course, the democratic agenda. So these are some of the thoughts that Prof and I will probe a little bit more, so that we share insight, drawing from his wealth of experience as a seasoned administrator in the Northwest Government. And obviously has been with government or in the public sector more broadly for a considerable time. And therefore, it's befitting to reflect on a State of the Nation address with the likes of Prof here. As I'm sure you as a listener, you might have any thoughts or views that you want Prof to respond to on specific issues. Our SMS line is 061-895-1019. Of course, your thoughts and views are welcome via my X handle, which is _@DrMbele. Without any waste of time, let me take this opportunity to welcome Prof.
Thank you very much. I'm really delighted to be here, and thanks for the invitation.
Your overview of the State of the Nation address last week, what was your take in terms of the posture, in terms of the issues that the president raised, particularly in the context of promises which were made in the past? How different is the State of the Nation address? To what extent do you think he was on point in raising pertinent issues, not so much as raising, but where to? The reason I'm asking this, Prof, is that half often we don't get to hear what the previous promises were by government. We only get to hear what they will be doing. Your overall assessment of the address?
Well, I guess the one critical thing that really stands out in the president's State of the Nation address would be, as you have already suggested, the question of economic growth in the country. And obviously, we do not only look at economic growth, but we look at the socioeconomic factors. I think we'll recall that in 2023, if I'm not mistaken, the president took the bold initiative of ensuring that there is a partnership between business and government. I think it was a very critical step, especially now that we're in the grip of energy crisis, and we would also recall that we had serious transport logistics at our ports, and in addition to that, in our broader society, we're afflicted by crime and corruption. The president touched on that. One other thing I think that is worth highlighting, we have a general problem of unemployment in our country, but sadly, if you look at demographics, the youth are more severely affected. It is gratifying to see that that is one of the priorities that the president spoke to. But let me go back to the question of energy, very strongly highlighted in the president's address. I think what underpins, you know, the way we as a country are tackling energy is the question of saying, let us mobilize and harness the resources, the critical resources we have in our country. So it's not only government, but it is also business that has come to the party since 2023. I must just say in passing an apology for some slight digression. We would recall that in 1998, business was in intensive discussions around what to do, because they were already concerned about the state of the economy at that time. And so in 1999, after those discussions, and as a result of having shared their views with government, Business Trust was established. Sadly, notwithstanding the fact that it did reasonably well, for one reason or the other, in 2011, it was discontinued. My own sense is, from a knowledge management point of view, we shouldn't really jettison projects that are as crucial and as impactful as those that were on the table, on the agenda of Business Trust. And needless to say, Business Trust was comprised of business as well as government, largely government ministers. And it did, you know, a great deal amount of work. And I think before I get to this, back to the specifics from the President's State of the Nation address, it would be useful for us to extract the lessons that we can learn from those experiences during the days of Business Trust. We would recall that at that time, the one issue that was prioritized was unemployment, and that is why Having looked at all the sectors then, it was determined that the tourism sector was performing excellently at the time. And so the tourism sector was used to address questions of unemployment at that time. And just as an aside, I had the opportunity to oversee a large part of that tourism initiative when I was MD of ECI Africa, an American company that was operating in Woodmead. But to come back to 2025 State of the Nation address, I think we're gratified to see the improvements that government together with business have really registered around matters of energy, and those interventions included the fixing of Eskom, adding new energy generation to the grid, and also promoting rooftop solar installations. And as we all know, these efforts have really gone far in contributing towards reducing load shedding and improving electricity supply generally. So I think we commend and appreciate the efforts led by our president in that regard. Now, the second major thing that I would lift from the State of the Nation address is transport as well as logistics. And in this regard, we have seen government and business working together to assist a major and critical institution such as Transnet. And in that context, we have also seen this partnership giving attention to the logjam that, as I said earlier, we're seeing at our ports, so as to streamline logistics, making sure that we are able to move our export goods as well as be able to move our import goods from our ports. So that was another very useful, interesting highlight of the State of the Nation address. The one other thing that the president spoke to was a question of crime and corruption. It is gratifying to see that this kind of initiative is actually focusing on securing electricity and logistics infrastructure. We know as we move around our cities, in particular the city where we sit in Johannesburg, we see the damage, the untold damage that has been inflicted on our electricity infrastructure, logistics infrastructure. So a lot has been due to the criminal element. The kind of destruction that we see is attributable to the criminality in our country. And that said, the partnership has also been hard at work in assisting the NPA as well as the DPCI in beefing up their capacity, streamlining prosecution of criminals and individuals involved in corruption. And that has really gone far in strengthening our criminal justice system. And although there is a lot that needs to be done, but we can say that bit by bit, this is increasing some safety to some extent of citizens in our country.
Absolutely. If I can just come in there, Prof, you've raised a number of pertinent points, which, you know, in your view, have sort of shed light in as far as the needle, economic performance needle, And which the president has spoken about. We all know that economy is the pillar of any growth. You know, you've also touched on unemployment rate, especially among youth. You know, maybe let's just look at tourism as one issue that ordinarily can be defined as a low-hanging fruit from job creation point of view. But in the same vein, we also have to look at tourism in the context of high level of crime. Make a classical example. I mean, township's economy are fertile ground, you know, for tourism, and yet crime is the biggest enemy. And we have not seen major initiatives. Gauteng obviously has the warden, you know, initiative that was brought to bear by the Premier of Gauteng, but we haven't really seen much traction, Prof. That's a reality. We haven't seen much traction just on how to leverage on tourism as a low-hanging fruit, because crime is the biggest enemy of growth. What is it that any of you ought to be looked at differently to strengthen tourism as a biggest employer or tourism has a biggest opportunities, you know, for employment, especially among youth? And I don't think we are succeeding there. Your observation as a former premier on that particular issue. We'll come back to issues of partnerships, which are very useful. And I hear every now and again you're talking partnership between government as well as business, which is the currency which we all need to marshal our sources again. But let's go back to tourism.
Yes, I think in my earlier comments, and alluding a bit to tourism, and you have also made mention of low-hanging fruit. I have said in my opening remarks that I really don't know. It is not quite clear why the Business Trust Initiative was abandoned. Because personally, having played quite a major role through this organization, ECI Africa, we actually were responsible for the tourism enterprise program. It clearly is low-hanging fruit. Crime was already prevalent at that time. Of course, it has gone far worse. So I would really say that, again, as part of knowledge management, what can we learn? What lessons can we learn from there? And one obvious lesson is that critical mass appears to be much easier in a sector like tourism. Yes, one can appreciate that the effects, the scary effects of load shedding were such that, you know, as you try to respond to a number of issues, and that we should not lose sight of the systemic nature of the challenges that we confront and make sure that our interventions do recognize the systemic nature of the issues that afflict us. So you look at tourism and you look at crime, which really militates against our efforts therein. But I guess virtually in every sector, we find the presence of crime. So the interconnectivity of various issues, various systemic issues, is what really gives us a stuck definition and description of the kind of challenges that we're confronted by. And I think what your question implies is that what is it? What is the toolbox that we bring you know, on site when we tackle some of these challenges? Is the toolbox comprising largely of technical issues, so that every problem that we address assumes a technical character? Or In addition to that, do we also have challenges that are so complex that sometimes we don't know what the causes of these problems are, nor do we know what the solutions are. And experiences throughout the world would tell us that if you are confronted by a myriad of issues, a complexity, a web of issues, there are certain approaches that we ought to adopt. Questions such as mind mapping, such as root cause analysis, such as systems thinking, so that you are better able to have a handle of an array of challenges that are afflicting us, in our society, in our economy. Having said that, I would really suggest very strongly that perhaps tourism is one sector that we should be looking at as we continue with this wonderful partnership between business and government. Perhaps the other thing about partnership is, what about the role of civil society? What about the role of citizens? In other words, what about active citizenry? Because a number of issues that relate to crime are resolved as a result of active citizenry. In other words, we don't leave it to the police. Mm-hmm. We don't leave it to the partnership, business and government. But we say, where is civil society? Where is active citizenry? The challenges in our country, and so would be the case in other countries, are such that those who have to come to the party are South Africans. It is government, it is business, it is civil society, it is citizens. And I'm just hoping that once the national dialogue get started, the whole question of active citizenry should be quite prominent on the agenda. Our challenges, in other words, Dr. Mbele, are too huge just to leave it to this partnership. We all have to come to the party, of course, in a way that is well coordinated and so on.
I'm with you, Prof, and I agree with you 100% that the problem are very complex, and in the complexity of this problem, all role players needs to, chip in, shoulders to the wheel. Let me just pause that and pull out one of the issues that you raised earlier in your reflection, that you identified logistics and Transnet in particular as one critical player, of which there has been a bit of traction from government to try and remedy, in the same way government has attempted to remedy energy issues. In transport logistics, we all know that the balance sheet of Transnet, as an example, is very weak. And there are two issues that I want to raise here. One is, the capability of these SOEs are not at the level which addresses some of these complex issues, one. And the other one, Prof, has always been the capability of the state. It is common cause that, the state, in terms of human capital, the technical side of addressing infrastructure, it's not where they're supposed to be. President often speaks of professionalization of the public sector, which also it's something that needs to be addressed. All these issues are important, but we don't seem to communicate. Government doesn't seem to communicate some of the successes, so that we build confidence in the public. Because the biggest challenge in Transnet, if my memory serves me well, there's two big tenders which they had to pull out purely because they were not done correctly. And that also speaks to institutional capacity in the SOEs to manage. Seasoned administrators such as yourself aren't party to that kind of configuration at Transnet, at PRASA, and so on and so forth. Noting the complexity of these issues, you overlay that with element of trust, which is dwindling every time. And you can't bring in, that's my view, you can't bring in partnership and you know to bear unless you demonstrate the trust level that you are bridging some of these issues. If you were to advise current administration on sorting out logistics, transport, because that's very key. We still have trucks damaging the roads. We still have trucks, you know, literally when you take your N3, N1, N14, trucks everywhere. And the time it takes to you and I, if you're commuting, productivity gets lost. For a trip that could ordinarily be taking you an hour, it's going to take you 3-4 hours, purely because we don't seem to get a handle on sorting out logistics, such that you know trucks are obviously moved away. There is sufficient investment to rail, and investment prof has to you as a private funder. I don't think there's sufficient incentives for a funder or a business person to come into that particular space, of which the sense that we're picking up is that regulations on these big mega projects are not in place or are not necessarily addressing the pain of the investor, so that there is incentives for private business to move in to alleviate the stress on the fiscus while promoting productivity and so on and so forth. Where are we? And what is it, again, what is it that we can do differently? Partnership, obviously, very land identified as a key lever that could strengthen logistics. But we're not there yet.
Yeah. You know, the point is, much as in respect of energy, respect of transport and logistics, the work that has been done around crime and corruption, youth unemployment, as contained in the president's State of the Nation address. You know, the point is, we often have the tendency to, as you know, other people would put it, to quickly fall in love with solutions. Before we understand what the problems are. And the danger with that kind of approach is that we end up solving the wrong problems. The fundamental thing in our public sector institutions, including SOEs, is the notion of neo-patrimonialism. Why is it that since 1994, we have allowed this neo-patrimonialism to fester, where functionaries seem to be unable to distinguish between what is mine and what belongs to the state. And that culture has, in a very scary way, permeated the fabric of our institutions, particularly in the public sector. I mean, even a simple thing like you get to a particular building, and maybe there is security at the gate. You tell them that I have an appointment with Dr. Mbele. And the guy at the gate says, oh, yeah, no, he is around, and we would help you and direct you. Yeah, but it's so hot, you know. How about some cool drink, you know? And it just shows you to what extent, you know, this whole question of a culture of corruption has permeated, as I say, you know, the fabric of our institution. So at all levels, we need to address the question of having, of course, ask the question, what is the problem? Mm-hmm. Address the question of neo-patrimonialism so that we begin to get people in our institutions that actually have the interest of our country at heart. But at leadership level, The question of servant leadership, such a basic fundamental concept. I am convinced that because we have such an absence in many instances of servant leadership, there is no way we're going to bring about change. There is no way we're going to address the issues that you talk to unless the Nimrod Mbele that you appoint, the top Mokora that you appoint, in terms of your assessment, you have satisfied yourself that indeed these are servant leaders because of the following, based on our assessment. I think we need to revisit the question of, in the context of employment, we find ourselves having to pay allegiance to two constitutions, the constitution of my party and the constitution of my country. Mm-hmm. And I think what comes to mind is the whole question of accountability.
Which one of the two take precedent? Because the constitution of the country needs to take precedent over the constitution of a party.
Well, maybe one way to respond to a very difficult question is to say, what influences our sense of accountability in the public sector? Maybe it is the electoral system. Our electoral system, whether you like it or not, compels functionaries, both political functionaries and well as administrative functionaries, to be accountable to the party when they should be accountable to the citizens, to the constituencies. And maybe as we grapple with the question of what is the problem, we probably want to start there. And I'm hoping that these are some of the things that would enjoy prominence at the national dialogue. But having said that, and still asking the question, what is the problem? Let us look at our NDP 2030.
Which, by the way, is, well, you know, some of the very, ambitions enshrined in NDP, which comes to 2030, we literally, what, six years to NDP.
Precisely.
We have not halved unemployment. We have not halved poverty. In fact, everything is gone. Everything has skyrocketed. And again, that's something that perhaps maybe we can reflect slightly more. There are two issues that you raised, Prof. Perhaps maybe that can synchronize the thinking, and the listener could benefit from your wisdom. You've spoken about a servant leadership, okay, which I completely agree with you. And if you are servant leadership, you are ultimately accountable to citizenry. You're not accountable to the party, and that requires government, especially jobs in government. Most people are serving at the behest of the politician. And that's where accountability lines blurs. Some of the MECs, some of the ministers appoint people so that they can obviously redirect resources to them, and that obviously came through in the Zondo Commission. So that is one part of the problem, that we as South Africans, we do not appreciate the importance of meritocracy. We bring people into spaces without proper experience and exposure, without proper requisite, technical skills for them to perform the function. So we cannot move away towards servant leadership when meritocracy does not exist. We have become accustomed to mediocre. The economy is performing at mediocre level. Our entities perform at mediocre level. A simple thing such as audit findings, all municipalities, audit findings, disclaimer. And why do we keep people? When you look at entities where there are boards and you get a disclaimer, why do we keep that board there in the first place? Why do we keep the CEO? By the way, this is happening every age will have adverse finding, and the problem also is lack of consequences. You know, how do we address that particular consequence? Because it's also discouraging for people who are hardworking, who have been denied opportunities by those who are closer to the power. But the question is, how do you instill the sense of, you know, the sense of accountability, the sense of meritocracy, as opposed to, you know, serving those that appointed us, and that also is a problem.
Yes, I think if you look at the question of accountability, and as I have suggested, and I come across many people who express that views very strongly, that perhaps the root, a fundamental issue that needs to be revisited. Mm. The late Fanzil Srabert tried to do that around this question of our electoral system, because our current electoral system says, no, you don't owe it to the citizens, the electorate, you owe it to their party. So I will understand my party principles, what their likes and dislikes are. If every time the leadership would like to have a packet of fish and chips, I hope we'll buy something healthier, and I'm just hanging around the office there, and I'm willing to go and buy. You know, after some time, come municipal elections, you say, you know, Job Mkhoro has always been responsive, he's obedient, and maybe we must make him a councillor. So it is on the basis to which I've been willing to buy fish and chips and whatever else for the party boss here that I am rewarded, not because of meritocracy. But if you look at chapter 13 of the work that was done that gave rise to NDP 2030. The report is very clear about changing the systems of appointment, bringing in meritocracy in the public service. Now, if you revisit the Public Service Commission pre-1994, it was done in such a way that it is not the political principal in your department who decides who is to be appointed, but it is a panel of, so to say, uninterested men and women whose business, whose qualifications is actually to understand, to identify, to assess meritocracy and make appointments on that basis. If I have been found to have my finger in the cookie jar, and there is overwhelming evidence, and action has to be taken against me, and I say to my principal, but I have not been charged, so I cannot, be put aside, then...
there's a problem.
It's a problem.
It's a big problem.
Yes, you continue to see what is happening.
You know?
Where people who have been fingered are leaders, are in high positions of leadership.
But if I can interject the problem, how does it make you feel as a seasoned, you're a premier in the Northwest, how does it make you feel when you see people who have been fingered and with overwhelming evidence, as you've put it, being back on a pedestal? How does that make you feel?
Well, it's a pity you're asking me, because I have to pay the price for fighting corruption when I was premier. Mm. I would be told from time to time, the party does not have money, and get your MECs to fund the party. I said, no, but that is budget that is meant for the citizen, the ordinary citizen, the historically marginalized citizen. And what the party needs to do is to go on a fundraising effort, to organize fundraising parties or mjikelelo or whatever you want to call it to raise funding. But I cannot be given instructions that say I must instruct MECs to fund the party. I refused completely, as I would refuse any time for as long as I'm alive. I don't do that. When that money, and understanding the extent of poverty in our country, understanding the fact that 28 million of our citizens
are hungry,
and we give them grants through SASSA, that situation is not sustainable, especially when you say so many people will benefit from this SASSA grant, and only a handful of people have to make it happen. In other words, taxpayers. So that situation cannot be sustainable.
Here's another issue, Prof. Accounts. Here's another issue around the separation between party as well as the state. My impression, based on what you just said, you obviously were targeted, and you because you were given you were meant to instruct your MECs to direct funds towards a particular issue, which had nothing to do with those people, but for the party. And I suppose going back to your point around the political system, and that is something a big project, which I don't think in the current climate, it will fly. So, but what's the reality? What is it that can be done within your control? That could push the agenda of delivery forward. Because it is one thing for president to make this big pronouncement, only to find that a person of your caliber, responsible individual, pushing accountability and making sure that budget that have been allocated go towards specific projects, and nothing happens. But how do we change that culture? Because from what we've seen, that culture permeates across. That is why we are in the mess that you are at.
Yeah, that's exactly the point about, I think one of the fundamentals would be the question, and we have touched on this, the question of the electoral system and therefore changing, the sense of accountability in our country. It cannot be that a number of functionaries, and I have personal experience of that, oftentimes you find yourself in a push where you have to make a decision between the party and the constitution. And you get punished because you followed your conscience and therefore the country's constitution. It doesn't. And I think we need to spend time and say, but let's interrogate this. Do you just prefer charges in terms of the other constitution and impose them on this? Why don't you look at the two documents together, for instance, and say, why did this functionary, why did this leader choose to behave in this particular way? The fact of the matter is, the struggle did not end in 1994 when you got this dispensation. It's a lifetime thing. It continues all the time. And it is about fighting amongst us the triple challenges of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. And it's an ongoing thing. And unless we do that, we will not get anything right.
Okay.
It cannot be that when I become mayor, suddenly I have a double or triple story house. I have 7 cars parked in my yard. And
that's why we need life audit.
And those who are not discreet end up with 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 women friends. It cannot be that our society can continue this way. And some of these things are glaringly
displayed. It's a culture of impunity.
Yes, we can all see it. I mean, I wanted to implement this thing of audit in the Northwest, lifestyle audit, and I had all kinds of bureaucratic tricks why it could not be implemented. And this is the thing, and you may find that the one that you're instructing to start the process is the very one who's got, you go back to the village home or wherever, who's got a palatial home out there, and I don't know how many vehicles. And this is the thing. And, you know, very often people want money from me. And I said, no, I don't. And they would either say, you are premier or you were premier. I said, yes, the salary of a premier is public knowledge. So you should know what the salary of a premier is. And therefore, you should not expect that I've got riches of money. No. And for your information, I didn't and I don't steal. So maybe that is why I'm unable to help you.
Sure. Prof, I mean, there's just so many issues. Unfortunately, I've run out of time. I certainly want to bring you back, to thresh some of these issues in a much more targeted fashion, because there's so much that you and I, discussed, which in my view have certainly opened the eyes of the listener, opened the eyes of South Africans on the challenges, the complex nature of leadership in public sector. And you are a typical case study, and I'm sure there are a whole lot of other bureaucrats, technocrats such as yourself, who have been challenged by these forces, so to speak, forces that are anti-development, because if you're going to siphon money from the state, you're not for development, you're against development.
Yes, exactly.
And what has been done? One of the issues that you've pulled out is issues around dialogues as one way of but we have to go beyond dialoguing. We have to go and execute some of these issues, because if recommendations, if AG has made a recommendation, we don't have to dialogue about it. We just have to action what the AG has said. If the NPA has made determination, we just need to act. We don't have to go and have, in this country, we have so many commissions and there's no action. Commission after this, commission of inquiry after this, we've got state capture. You and I, as we're sitting here, so many politicians who ought to be in orange overalls are loitering around and making a laughing stock of democracy. So we need to act. But perhaps maybe in our next conversation, we need to see how best you, from where you're sitting, can strengthen accountability mechanism. Because I believe you've got very strong insights on how to strengthen accountability. We want to partner with you and making sure that South Africa is not a failed state. And it's about mobilizing resources, people such as yourself, to have a conversation that can take the country forward. Your parting shot, Prof, how I wish I could have extended the time.
Yes, thank you very much. I think we're all looking forward to the national dialogue, where citizens of this country at all levels will be able to express their views for the betterment of our country. But when I listen to articles and people expressing themselves, there is a lot of what that they talk about. And the what are things that we know. Mm-hmm. And I think one thing that should be prioritized at the national dialogue should be the how. In other words, we look at the NDP 2030 and say, but we were supposed to implement this thing. Why have we not implemented?
On that note, on that note, once again, thank you very much for coming through. It has been absolutely beautiful. If you've just joined us, that was the parting shot from Professor Job Mokgoro, who is a former premier, a known technocrat in the public space, who has given us so much to mull over, so much to reflect on as we journey in restoration of the dignity that Mandela once bestowed on the system. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. We're going to have to leave it here. Be kind to yourself. Look after yourself. Be safe. Let's do this again. Shalom.